about the cultures of consciousness. For those of you listening live on the stream, you'll notice the synchronistic fact that the previous show had some gentlemen on it talking about the esoteric origins in Egyptian religion, which is a wonderful setup for our show today, because we'll be talking about a new book that just came out, an academic volume called Esotericism in African American Religious Experience. The subtitle, There is a Mystery. And as I was looking through this book, I was reminded of a very interesting moment that occurred. I think it was the second time that I visited Port-au-Prince in the early 1990s. And I was with my girlfriend at the time, and she was studying Haitian dance. And so, of course, we were also interested in Vodun or voodoo. And we encountered one particular fellow who was we were talking to him about possibly getting one of those Haitian flags. I can't remember the name right now, that have the veves on them. And he pulled out this book. And in this book, this handwritten book, were all of these designs. And I noticed as he flipped through the designs that while they featured many of the veves that I was familiar with, they were also included in this volume were a number of sigils and diagrams that I recognized from Western magic. And later that same day, looking at some graffiti that was along the side of, was near one of the central graveyards, I noticed that there was some Masonic iconography as well. And it was really kind of a shocker to me, because at that point I had sort of assumed that what we see in voodoo, as we do with Santeria or Candomblé, is sort of, you know, a kind of pure expression of African religiosity in the New World. And the more I've learned and I've come to realize, and as this book, Esotericism in African American Religious Experience, goes into with wonderful detail from a wide variety of perspectives and authors, is that the story of Western so-called esotericism or European esotericism and African American religious experience, and particularly on the mysterious side of things, is much more mixed up, complexly arranged than one might assume. And indeed, that's one of the great themes that that comes through this volume, which is really a long time coming, and something that I think is much needed as someone who's really interested in esotericism and magic and the occult and American New Age and all of the sort of the fringes of consciousness, the alternatives to mainline religion that have played such an important role in the United States, that there's sort of a gap in the larger conversation about these things in terms of the incredibly central role that African-American religion and seekers have played in developing this. And so this volume, just to give you a sense of some of the things that it covers, includes things like the voodoo use of Western ceremonial magical ideas and practices, as well as conjure, hoodoo, 5% Nation of Islam, the great Beverly Randolph, who was really one of the most significant occultists in the 19th century. He influenced Madame Blavatsky. He really was the first guy to talk about sex magic in a kind of modern occult vein decades before Aleister Crowley kind of ran with the football. The volume also has essays on Sun Ra and the Nubian Hebrews, and there's a great piece on pole dancing for Jesus. That's right, you heard it here for first, pole dancing for Jesus. So I look forward to, we'll be talking with one of the editors of the volume, Stephen Finley, who himself has written a great deal on the Nation of Islam. But before we bring Stephen on, we're going to bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
So I'm curious. I mean, that's quite a long list of items there, and there's a bunch more that I didn't talk about. But what were the things that sort of surprised you or intrigued you the most out of the materials covered by this book?
Oh, well, I, like you, just loved all the different viewpoints, because I'm a huge nerd following African-American stuff, because, like you, we're just huge fans of Paschal Beverly Randolph. So from there, I nerded out trying to trace all these origins of Western magic, which, of course, is so heavily influenced by Egypt. But then you have to be like, okay, well, if everything's going back to Egypt and Africa, like, this is something that we really have to just look at. And then from there, I got into all of this kind of hidden material about Moses and about how Moses was black. And a lot of people talk and joke about black Jesus and all that kind of stuff. But through reading like Zora Neale Hurston and these other books, I got exposed to that material that, in fact, probably a lot of even the biblical materials about Moses were about African, you know, traditions and stuff like that. So after I kind of opened to that whole world, it really shifted my perspective on like how a lot of people see voodoo or hoodoo or any of those African traditions and how taboo they are, but then how exactly the same they are to a lot of the biblical material and stuff. And so I was so delighted that in this work, people are finally starting to have that conversation and make comparisons like that.
Great. Well, yeah, and I do want to mention, though, I have to say, well, one unfortunate thing about this book, for those of you who are getting excited and going onto Amazon, is that because it is on the prestigious academic press Brill, it is prohibitively expensive for mere mortals. So I encourage you, however, to take the extra steps of getting it from your local library, Link Plus, interlibrary loan, and wait for the paperback edition, which will be coming out eventually and will still be overpriced, but that's the way it is with academic publishing sometimes, and it's still a very worthwhile volume. So with that said, let's bring on Professor Finley to the show. Hey, Stephen, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
So I wanted to ask you, one of the sort of subtitle of the book is There is a Mystery, which is, even though it's a simple phrase, it really kind of struck like a bell in my mind. And I'd love to hear where that phrase comes from and why that was important for you and the other editors when you were putting together this collection.
Well, I hope you don't mind if I'm slightly transgressive. After all, that's the kind of work I do, right? But I just wanted to say something about the conversation that you and your co-host were having, which was, to me, a very, very beautiful conversation. In fact, I just wanted to listen to you two for a while. Because the way you frame... And what's your co-host's name again?
Maja.
Maja, because the way you both framed the background of the book, as well as what makes the book somewhat controversial, was beautiful. I mean, that was exactly it, right? Many people who, in the Africana world, practice various forms of esotericism, trace it back to Egypt, literally, and others symbolically. But I think the questions that you raise were beautiful questions, and the way you framed it was equally as beautiful, as well as the lecture that you played leading up to it. Dr. Ben, I recognize his voice, was the scholar you were playing. I think he just died within the last week, actually.
Wow.
And
yeah, that was just a synchronicity, Stephen. I mean, I tune in, you know, 10 minutes before the show starts, and I just heard this, and I was like, wow, that's very interesting.
Crazy.
Uh-huh. And he's done a lot of work on sort of reclaiming Egypt in terms of its civilization, but also its science, religion, and many of the things that we're discussing right now. So I really just wanted to give both of you props. And I'm really serious. That was really, really a beautiful introduction and framing of this conversation.
Wonderful.
So if I might say something about There's a Mystery, we initially wanted that to be the primary title of the book. Esotericism in African American religious experience, or actually it was esotericism, Gnosticism, mysticism in African American religious experience, was supposed to be the secondary title. The press, of course, they want descriptive titles because that sells better. When people are looking for the material, There is a Mystery doesn't tell them what the book is really about so much as esotericism in African-American religious experience does. And one of the reviewers thought that we were talking so much more about esotericism than the other two, than Gnosticism and mysticism, and so we went with that. But the phrase there is Mr. X, it comes to us from African-American mystical traditions, especially that of Howard Thurman. It's a phrase that I found in Howard Thurman's book, Luminous Darkness. In the context of the phrase, he was actually talking about people who have been oppressed, in particular people of color, and how their gaze, as he describes it, how their gaze is sort of hidden behind certain practices that those who injured them miss. Right? They're secretive, they're hidden, they're coded, they're all of these things. And that's where I found the phrase. And that seemed so relevant to the kind of work and the kind of practices and ideas that interested the co-editors and I. And so we went with that, and it resonated with them, and we thought that should be the title. So really, Howard Thurman, who was, again, this African-American, you've heard the name, Christian mystic, is really the origin of that phrase.
Yeah, he's a San Francisco figure too. I'm a big fan of California mysticism, and he plays a really significant role in the city. And I'm happy. I found an LP, a recording of one of his sermons the other day, and I was very very pleased in a thrift shop. So that's, I'm glad to hear that origin story. But it points to something I think really interesting, is that I think there's probably a tendency when people think about, particularly the conditions of slavery, to imagine that these people were not allowed to read, they weren't being educated, they were living in these sort of brutal conditions that in some ways would restrict their worldview, maybe simplify their worldview, too, because there were such pressing needs at hand. But at the same time, the inner life, or the world that's not seen, that's still maintained as a place of flourishing, of human connection, of wondering, of what are we here for? The existential questions, the religious questions, they almost have to become more complicated, more encoded, more encrypted, because the outside reality is so brutal. So it's already complicated. It might seem like it would be more simplified, but it's actually more complicated, with more layers and more room for a kind of necessary mystery.
So I'm wondering if I could just pour some scotch, take a seat, and continue to listen to you and your co-host. I mean, that was a wonderful way of framing exactly the kind of complexity that we're trying to capture. And you're exactly right. Because of these sort of external realities, African Americans had to code and render secret and hidden many of their practices and ideas, and had to learn how to signify a lot, in which in some cases meant trying to act like, these clever language games, and trying to act like they weren't as complex, right, in order to protect them. What you said is just right.
Can you explain a little bit about that term, signify? I mean, it plays a really important role, in African-American culture, but also in the way of talking, as people try to understand and decode and go into the complexities of that culture. It plays a really important role.
When I mention signify or signifying, I have a few people in mind. One of them is Charles Long. He's the primary thinker I have in mind here. But Henry Louis Gates also plays prominently in my mind, who wrote a book called Signifying Monkey, in which he actually argues that these signifying practices in African-American culture that we also see in hip-hop and many, many aspects of African-American culture actually come from Africa or have their roots in Africa. But Charles Long has a really complex book. I shouldn't say complex, I should say complicated, called Significations, which was a collection of essays, articles, American Academy of Religion addresses since he was Long was once the president of AAR, that he put together in a collection after someone pointed it out to him that there was a stream of thought running through all of these essays, and they were right. Charles Long argues two things about signifying or significations. One of the things he argues is that black bodies were signified, black and brown, but he sees black bodies as sort of the quintessential bodies that were signified, while at the same time religion was signified. And what he means by that was that as religion was coming into being as a colonial category, that it was constructed literally out of the bodies of colonial subjects, black and brown people, which he calls empirical others. And so that's the context of the book. But one of the things he argues is that he learned about signifying most immediately in Arkansas, which is where he's from, I think rural Arkansas or somewhere outside of one of the cities. And so one of the things he used to hear when he was younger, Charles Long says, is that signifying is worse than lying. Right, that was one of the colloquialisms that he used to hear. And signifying is worse than lying for Charles Long and for the community that he comes from in Arkansas, because it's a clever language game. It circumvents the rules of discourse without taking responsibility for doing so. And that's why signifying is worse than lying. It's a game that doesn't take responsibility for changing the rules, for transgressing, and so on. And so there are a lot of ways that Charles Long argues signifying plays out in African-American culture. I might say, for example, something really simple. I might say America's a great nation. I could say that. But what if I said America's a great nation? Right? So even an intonation for Long is a way of critiquing the culture. Or being critical. That second example that I just gave, it was a slight change of intonation, but with that was very critical. Right? And so Long argues that African Americans developed this skill of signifying on America, signifying on religion, signifying on all kinds of things. And this is one of the central features of African American culture. I hope your listeners aren't real sensitive, but one of the primary ways of signifying is by taking a term or a category that was oppressive and changing it slightly so that the meaning is changed. For example, you'll hear in popular discourses that are really uninformed, well, if the rappers can say nigger, how come we can't, right? Charles Long would say that's really silly. Charles Long would say that nigger and nigger are two very, very different words. He would say that African Americans took this really oppressive word that was associated with slavery, changed it slightly, and then redeployed it in a way that made it a new word, that had new meaning. So in effect, it's not the same word, right? And we talk about this in some of my classes, especially my class on hip-hop, but also the courses I teach on the religious thought of Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. They were both frequently signifying on American values in order to flip those values and flip the meaning of it and shine a mirror and a light back on America that was critical. For example, Martin Luther King was always framing himself, rather than America sending missionaries out to the world to colonize and Christianize the world, one of the ways he understood African Americans were as missionaries to America, to speak justice to America, to hold America to its own Christian values. But that's a form of signifying, right? Signifying on the Constitution. And so this is an important aspect of African-American culture that, yes, we do see in these religious practices. In fact, again, when we're talking about Charles Long, Martin Luther King, etc., signifying is most clearly seen in African-American religion, at least for me it is.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. You mentioned Martin Luther King, and of course, when people think about religion and African Americans, they're going to think about the black church. They're going to think about the great leaders that come out of the black church. And that's really the sort of central image of religion, whether it's, Baptist services or, the kind of powerful civil rights movements. Those are the sorts of associations that people make. But of course, you also mentioned Malcolm X, who comes out of the Nation of Islam. And the Nation of Islam opens up to a very different kind of current or set of currents within the United States, within the Americas in general, that, if you will, sort of elided or parallel the kind of dominant story about the black church. And since I know, studying African-American religion, the black church is so central that for you to kind of carve out the space to look at these more esoteric, alternative, in many ways inventive and creative forms of religiosity, you had to do some work to kind of make space for that. And you address that in the introduction. So I'd love to hear a little bit about, while recognizing obviously the importance and the significance politically, culturally, the fascination with the history of the black church in America, also in a way how the dominance of it occludes other important stories.
And I've said again, you've said a lot, and a lot of things that are really important. And I've said it before. I even said it in my recent paper at the Gnosticism conference, that for me, even within academia, this focus on black church studies was a problem, in that it obscures other forms of African American religiosity, other ideas and practices that have always existed in African American religion and culture. My aunt, for example, was Baptist. She's no longer living. And she would always keep a horseshoe facing upward, a metal horseshoe facing upward in front of her door. Right? So there were always those little practices, and that was meant to bring good luck, to bring other things in the house. I was told if the horseshoe was turned downward, that would mean things that weren't good, right? Now she was Baptist, but she would tell me in a heartbeat what color candle to burn if I needed some money. And she would say it, Eric, like I'm supposed to know. She would say, boy, burn you a green candle, like I'm supposed to know, right? Like this is so self-evident, right? And so, but if we just focus on the Baptist, we miss the other practices that coexist and are intermingled constantly in African-American lived religion and culture. And I'm simply saying that this is exactly what's happening in popular discourses and in academia, that this focus on the black church, which is sort of a pious a commitment to black church by many scholars, in some ways is problematic, in that it keeps us from seeing these other practices that may even be more paradigmatic of African-American religion than these bigger, right, ways of understanding it, such as in terms of the black church.
Yeah. Well, and it does. It actually works, yeah. I think, to prevent equality, to prevent, yep. Like, they need those signifiers to show, like, what reality is, not, like, who says it's this or who says it's that, like, whether African-American religion is just people who go to Baptist church or just voodoo, like, that sends it to either end of the extreme, when what you see exhibited in people's real lives is, like you said, like, part of both of those things are inherent in all of it. So it's almost like I felt like all those things you're saying and what you guys put forth in the book is like, oh, hey, guess what? This is what's actually happening for anyone who's interested. Reading some of these ideas, but let's look at what actually occurs. And I feel like significant about it.
Well, and I appreciate that, because that is exactly what we're doing. And that's why I said that these might be really the paradigmatic forms of African-American religion, more so than the dominant representations of black religion in scholarship and in the culture. And this is why I appreciate Mitch Horowitz's chapter in Occult America on African-American religion, where he sort of re-envisions African-American religious history focusing on the occult, on conjure, on these practices that are marginalized, these esoteric practices and ideas, in a way that to me brings African American religious history much more alive. And that's indeed what we were trying to do in this chapter, because you have to dig hard, number one, but number two, in a culture where it's much easier to get published doing black church studies or things that are familiar to folks or things that fit the script, this project was a lot riskier and a lot more challenging to pull together. But the thing is, I've been thinking about this for a while. So when Margarita and I, Margarita Simon Guillory, one of the co-editors, decided that we were going to do such a volume, I already had in mind 10 or 12 people who could contribute. And so, I mean, talk about synchronicity. I mean, the project just sort of came together. And I didn't have to issue a call to papers. And the truth is, there were people out there doing this kind of work. There just weren't that many of them, and many of them were not in religious studies, oddly enough.
That's very interesting. You know, it's funny. I want to ask a number of different questions. We got to take a break in just a second, but before we do, I just wanted to pick up. You know, I love that story about the horseshoe and your aunt, I believe. And I'm just wondering, uh-huh, now when now that you've established yourself, looking at the kind of work you're doing now, are there other elements from your own experience, background, things going on in the corner, people you met, et cetera, that now you see were kind of had these much richer, deeper stories behind them that maybe you missed at the time, but that kind of set you going towards these interests?
I'm not sure if it set me on that path so much as it made them more meaningful once I started going down this path. Like, I remembered them more, and I thought of them more, and I thought of some of the stories my mother would tell, who still doesn't want to talk. She may be listening, by the way. I did send her a text, so I hope she's not upset by this, but doesn't really want to talk about some of these things, these ideas and practices, even in her own family, that really interest me. For example, in her family in East Texas, part of our family were slaves in East Texas, by the way, and There was a part of her family that came from Nacogdoches, Texas. She lived more in Laneville, which was in Rusk County. If you don't know East Texas, that won't make any sense to you. But there was a part of the family that she mentions they didn't talk about a lot, and that they didn't round a lot. And part of that, the idea was that they were doing voodoo. And see, I want to know about that, because I think that says something more significant that could be meaningful for me, given that this was part of my family. But there's still so many kind of negative meanings attached to this that even she doesn't want to talk about it.
That's fascinating. Well, I think we're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dahu. We're talking with Professor Stephen Finley about African-American esotericism, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dahu here with Eric Davis. Today we are speaking with Professor Stephen Finley about esotericism in African American religious experience. And before the break, Stephen, I really like everything you're talking about, but I really liked what you were saying about that taboo aspect and coming into a confrontation with it, with even within your own family. Because this is really, it goes back to the secret and mystery stuff that you were talking about before. Yeah. And I feel like it's literally people's reactions to taboo, which is what causes all the kerfuffle in the first place, right? And that kind of prevents access. The gnosis is our own, like, dumb reactions to what we think is something terrible. When I've kind of adapted this Wizard of Oz mentality where most things you think are taboo and evil and awful, you can, like, kind of find a man behind the curtain of all of them, and it's always like, oh, it's this. It's not even that thing that I thought that it was. So I wonder if you can help some of the listeners and myself and everyone, maybe from your perspective, What did you feel, and through going this experience of publishing this book, which is controversial, and perhaps maybe having to, you know, face some of those terrors at exposing taboo yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, what, as individuals, how do we get people to pop past these, like, kind of illusions that we have about things to just get people to look at things?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can help a lot with that, because for me it was just the thing to do. It was just the right thing to do. It's what motivated me. My job as a scholar is to produce knowledge. You don't produce knowledge by reheating old chicken. Mm. Right? I mean my job is to uncover that which hasn't been uncovered, is to dig, you know, new earth. And so I'm motivated mostly by these practices that have sort of been muted by these dominant meta-narratives. For example, that the black church is African-American religion. And there's this whole politics of respectability that sort of structures what gets talked about and what doesn't. Christianity is, you know, in this culture, seen as much more respectable and much more acceptable. Even Frederick Douglass hid his experiences when he wrote of himself in his autobiographies. You may be familiar with Frederick Douglass' story and how
I love
he was.
Him. Yeah.
Well, he was. Well, you'll have to tell me if you've heard of the slave breaker, Mr. Covey.
So
Frederick Douglass was sent to him. Well, he was a notorious slave breaker who was an expert at breaking unruly slaves. And Mr. Auld, A-U-L-D, who owned Frederick Douglass, sent him there because, you know, young Douglass was just, he was just incorrigible. And Mr. Covey just beat him seriously. I mean, so seriously that he left there begging and went back begging his master for forgiveness. His master had no mercy. He sent him back. He said, "You have to go back to Mr. Covey's." Well, one night before going back to Mr. Covey's, he was hanging out in the dark in the woods, and he met this man. I forget his name. Perhaps his name will come back to me in a moment. Jenkins, Sandy Jenkins was his name. Sandy Jenkins offered him two roots in the shape of testicles, and this is how Frederick Douglass describes it. And he told Douglass to take these, and that these will give him strength to challenge Mr. Covey and to endure Mr. Covey. Well, Frederick Douglass takes those roots and goes back to Mr. Covey. Mr. Covey tries to punish him for running away in the first place and wrestled with Frederick Douglass for 2 hours and could not subdue him. Frederick Douglass said a spirit of unknown origin came over him and gave him the strength and the fortitude to challenge Mr. Covey.
Wow.
Now here's the point. When he gets to some of his later writings about his life, he redacts that. He doesn't talk about meeting Sandy Jenkins, the conjure man, in the woods, nor taking those roots and those roots having some...
Looks like we lost Stephen, so we're going to bring him back.
Oh,
but I know
secrets. We're too deep. We're telling too many.
I know,
secrets.
Man. We got to do this. But I know the end of the story, because actually Mitch Horowitz, it's in the Occult America book that Stephen was talking about. And you know, basically, he just, when he tells the story later in his life, he elides that whole bit of the conjure. And of course, those kinds of roots are very important within conjure or hoodoo, the kind of, you know, widespread practices that come out of African American and some white European folk magic roots. So it's a really interesting thing, and I know that in Occult America, Mitch, we've had on the show a couple times, he makes a big point about that, is that there's a way in which there's a kind of understory even beneath the kind of major stories we know. So we think of Frederick Douglass, this great orator, this brilliant man, you know, probably the most famous former slave in the 19th century in terms of the effect he had and his just incredible integrity. And yet he too had to kind of, you know, hide his relations with this kind of understory that really goes throughout the whole picture. Hmm. So hopefully we'll be getting Stephen back. Snora, I know that there going to be they're calling him up again on PRN. So we're just going to keep chatting here until we get him back. I guess I talk more about some of the pieces I read in the book that really kind of blew my mind. There was a wonderful piece on the poetry of Sun Ra by Marcus Redd, and what kind of blew my mind is I'm already a huge fan of Sun Ra's music and his whole persona. I was really lucky; I got to see him a couple of times, including a free show in Central Park with none other than Sonic Youth. And at that show, I ran into John Zwed, who wrote the great biography of Sun Ra. So you know, I've been a fan for a long time, but it was only recently that I discovered that his poetry, some of which you know appears and is chanted in the songs. But a lot of which he wrote as poems and put out in chapbooks and other collections is like really remarkable. And you know, at first it's sort of like, oh, these are kind of song lyrics, they're kind of repetitive, you know, Afro Black, this and that, da da da. No, they're really, really profound. It's just sort of spooky, brilliant works of mystical poetry, and that was really. You know, really, you know, great stuff. So it's pretty cool. And so that was, you know, one of the great things that I discovered in the show. And let's see, what else are we going to talk about here? I'm going to keep trying to...
You know, one of the things that I've been thinking about through the conversation is just that so many, it's my favorite example of people who actually are sorcerers and are wizards and are living the ancient Egyptian teachings. Anyone that kind of has to, like, come up against some kind of ostracization or becoming an outsider, like he had mentioned, right? You get, like, kind of this stigma, like, you're less than or you're not worthy. And then those individuals that do that actually have to do the entire alchemical process to do those, like, signifiers, like, am I worthless? Is that true, right? So it kind of forces this inside, which is what all the Egyptian material talks about, is being able to achieve a state like how Frederick Douglass did. That's like the whole point of all the Golden Dawn teachings, of all the alchemy stuff, is to become like this autonomous individual who is like free or liberated. So I love the stories of the slaves that were actually literally able to liberate themselves in the most oppressive situations. They're like true, real sorcerers, in my opinion.
Well, one of the interesting tensions in the book that comes up is how some groups and individuals use mysticism and esoteric practices in order to sort of touch a part of the self that is not captured by our concrete categories of gender, race, nationality, that's something that's more than or different than all of those specific ways in which we're different from one another. And right. So that makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense why, you know, as someone, you know, oppressed, dealing with white supremacy, dealing with all of the historical ramifications of slavery, et cetera, where your body is so marked by the surrounding culture, that the idea that there is a way of connecting with the spirit, not like in a Christian sense, like we're all one family, but that there's something in the self that is not marked by race or gender or nationality, is a really powerful potential, really powerful possibility. So some groups and people, you know, captured in the book, go down that route. But at the same time, there's this other route, which is what you'd have to call kind of a black supremacist route, where, you know, to some degree in the Nation of Islam, certainly more so with the Nubian Hebrews and with some other groups, where they're basically like, you know, white people are a kind of abomination. They're kind of like the archons in Gnosticism. They're these sort of lower demiurgic, half evil trickster creatures who are oppressing, blacks, and particularly black men, and that the spiritual renovation, the esoteric transformation, the apocalyptic revisioning of the world will occur through their overcoming. And that makes sense too. You know, I mean, they're like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, sure, I could totally see the appeal of that kind of story as well, looking at you know, what happened and looking at slavery and trying to even understand how these people managed to oppress and enslave peoples with such a glorious past. I mean, you know, West Africa was no joke. It wasn't just a bunch of mud huts. I mean, it was real civilization with, you know, roads and city systems and, you know, scholars and, you know, I mean, it was full on. So both of these modes, which are both really parts of esotericism, are almost made even more clear with in this kind of collection. So we're trying to get Stephen back. I just want to let people know something that seems to be up with his phone. We're trying to Skype him in, but Maj and I are just going to keep talking about this stuff, and hopefully we'll come back on before we're done. So go ahead.
Well, it seems interesting if you do think about that. Like what you said totally tickled me a little bit, where it is, it's like, how do these people enslave entire, like, amazing races of people? Like, how does this go down? Because this is an interesting question, right? Then you get to some, like, maybe there are these external forces that we can allow into our vessels that give us some kind of superpower over others. Like, how could it be? It's almost like when you, like, how circus trainers kind of chain the elephant down, and then for the rest of its life, it doesn't try to escape because it always just thinks it's chained. It's like some kind of trick like that, where there's some kind of crazy thing with human beings where some groups of them do some mojo, whatever, and then enslave entire races of people. And that kind of happens, like, over and over.
Yeah, there was a fascinating article in Fortean Times, you know, probably my favorite magazine, and I think it was just a couple of months ago, and what it was about is the way in which superstition was used immediately following the Civil War during the period of Reconstruction as a way to terrify slaves, because, you know, I always wonder, like, why do the Ku Klux Klan look like that? They look so terrifying, right? Well, yeah, of course they're terrifying, but part of the white robes and the no eyes is to, like, spook people out, to make sure that freed slaves, and even during periods of slavery, it went back to slave times where if you wanted to get out and, like, go visit your friend over at the other, you know, a couple miles away, you'd have to go at night. You'd have to go through the forest. These guys would be there to kind of spook people out. So they would also use, you know, whatever you want to call it, folklore or superstition as a way of controlling populations. So you get into this weird magical battle where, you know, folklore, esoteric ideas, mystical ideas can be used kind of both ways. And it's a really complicated thing.
Well, it's all about propaganda, and what, you know, Stephen was talking about earlier with the language tweaks and how those are used are very important in that, because if you think about it, like, not only did certain individuals enslave all these, you know, black people from Africa, but what they also did was convince the rest of the population in the United States that that was cool. So it was like, not only do they enslave the people they're enslaving, but they also do a mind trick and hypnotism over all the people that then are like, oh, I guess this is okay, because it's like they're doing it, so that's cool, right?
So, Stephen, do we have you back on the line?
You do indeed. And, you know, that's what happens when you don't live in a major city. I live in sort of a rural environment, and, well, it happens, but I'm glad to be back.
Well, yeah, I bet you have some nice stuff out your front window, better than the asphalt that I have.
Yep. I'm looking at water in a pond right now. It's beautiful.
Well, I one of the things we were just talking about was how there's sort of two interesting strategies that you see a number of the groups discussed in the book take vis-a-vis race, and one of them is this kind of almost Gnostic approach, where what is sought through the mysteries, through mystical work, through esoteric practice, is that part of the self that is not marked by race, by gender, by nationality, by the particular personality, where there's something found that's higher than that, or different than that, or more abstract, more universal. And on the, at the same time, you also see other strategies, you know, to a degree with Nation of Islam, more true with the Nubian Hebrews and other groups, of a kind of esoteric black supremacy, where there, it's actually a story of the oppression by these sort of weird mutant trickster white people of a, you know, of black populations, and that the sort of transformative or apocalyptic work of the esoteric tradition is partly to restore black people to their you know, role as the kind of supreme. And they both make sense. And yep. I'm really curious how you, I don't know, wrap your head around this dialectic, this dynamic, well, that, you know, I'm kind of simplifying it a little bit, but it's a really interesting, because it really goes to the question of who we are, what is race, yeah, et cetera, et cetera.
I agree. Now I would reject the term of black supremacist, and I would remind you and the listeners that, again, what the Nation of Islam is doing is signifying on the categories of white supremacy that rendered black bodies inferior. Mm. So rather than see themselves as inferior, the Nation of Islam used all kinds of symbols and categories from a variety of science fiction, religions, and fashioned a mythology. In other words, they took all of this stuff and they signified upon it. They took white supremacy, they signified upon it, they used these same categories and threw them back in a critical way to say, okay, we don't enslave anybody, there's no system of power by which we oppress anybody, and yet we're seen as blackness is associated with evil, the devil, everything that is bad and dirty. And they flip that, and they say, but who colonizes the world? So what they're doing, in fact, is not a form of black supremacy so much as it is a form of signifying on the categories that have historically been used to oppress black and brown people all over the world. And they've used them critically, right, to say something about the world and about white supremacist capitalist patriarchy in a really creative and rich way.
No, thanks for that clarification. That makes a lot of sense. But still we have that question of, like, is the self that is sought, or is the spark that is sought in these esoteric practices more intensely African-American or black, or something that's beyond or abstract or no longer located in that? And do you see that as like a really important
both.
Tension in the whole
both.
Kind of discourse?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would actually say it's both. That, again, there's lots of signifying going on in these practices and symbols. So rather than black people being these empirical others out of which modernity is constructed, when we look at these particular groups, we see that they move blackness both to the center, back to the center, both as a way of bringing particular meaning to black bodies, but also a way of signifying the universal, right? So everything comes from darkness, right? In the universe is darkness. The earth emerged, the stars, from darkness, right? And so it's more of a metaphysical conception of race, although you're exactly right. There are others who have tried to jettison race. But even in trying to jettison notions of race, they're still trying to counter meanings that were attached to black body vis-a-vis white supremacy, colonialism, and et cetera. So it's two sides to the same coin. It's the particular and the universal. And
Wonderfully said. I wanted to ask you, throw it back a little bit more on
sure.
the sort of metaphysics of blackness, because that came mm-hmm. up in Marcus Red's piece about Sun Ra, as well as other selections, and I really love that particular piece. And that really struck me, because even in, you know, if thinking as someone interested in Western esotericism, in European esotericism, and even in something like the Kabbalah, where you have this sort of notion at the very peak of a kind of a sort of empty plenitude that's associated with the void, that's associated with blackness. And
right.
it seems
that's
to me that one of the things that's happening here that's really profound, it's not just that, oh, yes, African-Americans have their own esoteric practices and they go, you know, whatever, they're mixed up like everybody else's. It's that there's actually something really profoundly primal about yep. the sort of metaphysics of blackness and by extension the role that African-American esotericism in all its forms has played in America, like a primary role, not a role that's like, oh, those guys have their own thing, but there's something really central and originary about this stuff. That's and that's right. really the kind of most radical point I think you're making in the book, and you talk about it in the introduction as well, is that, you know, the American difference with religion is not just because it's a whatever, you know, it was formed as a constitution, or it had a big country, or it had, you know, Protestants who were creative. No, it's the role and the presence of African Americans that helped make American religion so different and as esoteric and conventional. So there's something really primary there, and, you know, we could talk about Egypt, blah, blah, blah. Unfortunately, we only have 5 minutes left. I'm glad we got you back, but I would just like to hear you say a little bit about that sense that of that primalcy.
Well, I think you're exactly right again, that there is something primal, something primordial about the way these groups constitute blackness as a symbol, as a metaphysics, to use your word, as a metaphor, right, for something originary, the origins of the earth, the origins of humanity, right, from the continent of Africa. They're constantly signifying, or the blackness of space, right, as in the alien. They're constantly signifying on this idea of blackness, not as something dirty and messy, but something that's, again, particular in that it signifies people who have been colonized and enslaved, not simply as the raw material out of which the West emerged, but as central figures, central actors, subjects rather than objects. And on top of that, it signals something universal. Right? So when you hear Louis Farrakhan and others talking about these alien marriages, it's easy to dismiss that as folly. But I think that the deeper meaning in them that I think, even though Farrakhan talks about blackness and the United Nubian Nation of Moors are talking about blackness with respect to aliens, the point is, I think, is that we're all aliens, right? And that there's something to be said about understanding people who are not structured by the boundaries of race, by the boundaries of nation, nation states, by the boundaries of gender. In some ways, we're that stuff, but then we're not that stuff, right? We're more than that, but we're not signified by those things. In fact, you know, we're aliens in a vast universe, right? Travelers, co-sojourners, and in some ways, I think that's what some of the mythology that we see in these black esoteric groups is really trying to get at. Right. Even though they're talking about the particular language, it has an application that I think refers to everybody. And that's really the point that I think is important.
That's so wonderfully said. I think we're going to leave it there. We only have a minute left anyway. So I wanted to thank you again, Professor Stephen Finley, one of the editors of this great volume, Esotericism and African American Religious Experience. And again, you're going to have to hustle, get to the library, you know, find it, find it somewhere. It's kind
of a
pain,
but
it's worth it. So thanks again, Stephen.
Thank you both. Have
All
a
right.
wonderful afternoon. All right, bye-bye.
All right, folks, from me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.